culture is what originally took me to the continent, my fascination with it, my excitement for it. And so this is an up session as opposed to some of the more negative ones or more critical ones. This is one we can where I hope we will do a little celebrating of African culture and some of the promise that it represents. So I'm excited about being able to talk with positive enthusiasm for once. I thought, having said that, I thought I'll turn right around and contradict myself. Now, I thought we might start with a couple of aspects of African culture which have proven problematic to Westerners. There are some things about African culture which, from an African's perspective, may be positive, but from a Westerner's perspective, are certainly not positive. And I think chief among these is the African concept of time. If you've had any exposure to Africa, you know that Westerners who visit Africa are very fond of talking about African time. And that means that if you show up a half an hour late, in parentheses, to an event, that's perfectly okay. That's African time. And to a Westerner, it seems that Africans are always late, that they're never running on time, that they don't pay any attention to their watch. And this can be really irritating to a Westerner who is used to operating on schedules, who expects an airlines, for example, to run on schedule, or expects transportation, other forms of transportation to run on schedule, or department stores or grocery stores or banks or whatever to open when they say they're going to open and to close when they say they're going to close. And to a Westerner who's always got their eye on the watch and organizes their whole day in according to a quantitative measurement of time, the African concept of time is really problematic, and I think is one of the things that has caused us to overlook some of the strengths of African culture. Now, I think that the African concept of time, viewed from their perspective rather than from our own quantitative perspective, is that time is not based on a mechanical instrument like your watch. Time is a sense that you have, and that key to how you organize your time are your obligations in relationship. In other words, if you're staying in someone's home, and you've got an appointment first thing in the morning, it's understood that by virtue of, say you've got an appointment in town in the morning, but you're staying in the home of a family, it's understood that when you get up in the morning, you, by virtue of receiving hospitality from that family with whom you stay, you have certain obligations in the form of relationship with the family. And the next morning, your number one priority will not be keeping an eye on your mechanical instrument that you wear on your wrist, so that at 8 o'clock you will be in town to meet this appointment. Your sense of priority will be with the people in whose home you're staying. And that means that you get up in the morning and you have breakfast with them and you share some time with them. And that's, once that relationship has kind of run its course and breakfast is over, and how can you anticipate what time another person will offer you breakfast? I mean, that's their business, and you are just a guest in their home. So once that kind of cycle of relationships has run its course, then it's time to move on to your appointment. Not when the hand is pointed somewhere on a watch. I mean, that's really a foreign way of measuring time to an African. And I think there is a certain strength to that concept of time. Africans are tuned much more into the people in whom they are with whom they share a relationship, and they feel a very strong sense of obligation to each other as a result of those relationships. And that's a priority for them in the way they measure their time. A lorry driver, a lorry is a little pickup truck with a canopy over the back, and it's the most common form of transportation in Africa. Underneath the canopy in the back of the pickup truck, there'll be a couple of benches, and if you want to get from one city to another, the cheapest way to do it is by lorry. And I remember when I was first in West Africa, we used to travel by this method of transportation because we had no other alternative at that point. And we would go down first thing in the morning to the lorry park and asked the drivers which, you know, who's leaving first? What time are you going to leave? And they all said, we're leaving first, and they all said, we're leaving in a few minutes. And not a single one of them was going to leave until the lorry was full. I mean, although it did usually turn out that whichever lorry driver got our business tended to leave first because he had whites in his lorry, and then that was a selling point for trying to attract other customers to use his lorry. But the point was that he didn't leave until he had a full truck. And the quicker we signed up with him, the quicker he would leave. So there was a certain element of honesty to the way he answered our questions. Soon. Now. So African concept of time is both something that has interfered with Westerners' appreciation of Africa and also something that, from an African perspective, is a real strength of their culture, I think. A second thing that has served as a kind of a barrier for Westerners, but in and of itself is a positive thing, I think, is language. I did my master's thesis in the Divinity School on African missions and came to the conclusion in that thesis, it was a critique of African missions, and my single strongest conclusion was that missionaries failed to learn the language of the people among whom they worked. Now, this was not true of the initial missionaries. The first missionaries that went out often took language very seriously, and they learned it. But after that first wave of missionaries hit the African continent, and schools were established in English or French or whatever the native European tongue of the missionary was, from that time onward, missionaries have at least felt it wasn't necessary to learn the language. And often they even felt that it was better to speak with the Africans in the European tongue because this set a good example for them. And it encouraged them to study the academic languages of the world. I feel pretty strong that it's accurate to say a basic problem for Westerners in going to Africa has been a failure to learn the language, the indigenous language of the people there. Now that is another thing which has interfered with our ability to really appreciate African culture, because because language is a strength that Africans have. Now, I'm going to share with you some of Xhosa, which is the language I learned. Xhosa is a common language spoken in South Africa, spelled Xhosa. And the X sound in Xhosa makes a click. X is a lateral click off the side of your mouth. Put the tongue against the side of your mouth. C in the same language makes a sound. Put the tip of your tongue at the top of your back front teeth. Suck. And Q, you pop your tongue off the roof of your mouth. Tombu is the name of a town right near where I live. Now the song last night is from Namibia, which also has some clicks in the language.
And Zulu.
And Zulu has some clicks, but we who speak Xhosa maintain that Xhosa is the click language. And in fact, Xhosa has more clicks than any of the other languages. Well, it has three main clicks, X, C, and Q, but every one of those clicks has variations when set next to different consonants. For example, the G, Q is different from a Q, A. So it's the same. As a Westerner, all you have to learn are the three basics. But if you want to speak pure Xhosa, then there's any number of variations. Well, not any number, but there would be certainly more than seven, I would guess, 20, 30 different clicks in terms of the subtle variations. So Xhosa has more clicks than any of the other languages in Southern Africa, but most of them have at least a few clicks in them. Now, to give you an example, well, first of all, language in Africa, Africans come out of an oral tradition. They are not people who would write, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, meaning particularly the written Word. Whereas our culture has been a literate culture for a long time, and for that reason we define history, for example, in written terms, and we talk about prehistorical people, we mean people that have not written down their history. And so we call the Africans prehistoric people. Until the whites came, Africans had no history because they weren't writing it down. Well, Africans weren't writing any of their language down. They had an oral language culture, and so their history, for example, was told in oral terms, and we're only today, in some academic circles, beginning to appreciate the strengths of oral tradition in African culture. And there have been, I've seen some analyses of African culture which suggest that the oral tradition, the stories that were passed down from one generation to another, maintained what we would consider to be a very high degree of integrity in relation to what is true. Westerner would say, well, if you don't write it down in 1550, how do you know in 1950 that you're dealing with a true story? If you wrote it down in 1550, then you can see it's written there, and you know that you're telling the same story 300 years later that you were telling 300 years before. Even though use of language has changed, and the words may not mean the same thing that they did when they were written in 1550, we still consider that written form to be a true form. Well, for Africans, they told the story orally. And some people that have begun to investigate this scientifically have come to the conclusion that there's a remarkable degree of truth maintained across generations through the oral tradition. So African culture was traditionally an oral culture, and therefore it stands to reason, although we haven't really figured this out, that their oral language would be a very rich language. And in fact, Xhosa I found to be a highly poetic, very beautiful language. I'll give you some illustrations. If you take...
How many letters are there in the alphabet that they use?
Well, they use the European alphabet.
Oh, they use the Arabic.
Because, see, that's a written thing now. And the way that the African languages went from oral to written was through the missionaries. Okay. And this, it's interesting, the same African sound... let me back up. How do I say this? In South Africa, you've got the Xhosa people living right next to the Sesotho people. Okay. Now, the Xhosa people were worked among by British missionaries. So the first people that wrote down the Xhosa language were English missionaries. The Sesotho people were originally worked among by the French missionaries. So the first people to write down the Sesotho language were French. Now, in both languages, the languages are different, and for the most part, they have different sounds, different words, so forth. But some of the sounds, they share. For example, the word you, Y-O-U, in both languages makes the same sound, wena. However, a British missionary writing down the sound wena would, of course, spell it W-E-N-A. A French missionary would spell it... Like that? I don't know French.
How's it spelled?
Well, I mean, this is... It's the same. Originally, it wasn't spelled at all.
But we can't see what you wrote.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's O-U-N... I don't know what the last... Who knows enough French to know what the
probably
last...
Probably O-U-I-N-A.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Wina.
Wina. I don't think there's an I in there.
Maybe Una, then.
Well, maybe there is an I. I don't know. Anyway, I know that the spelling of the word is radically different in Sesotho... And Xhosa, even though the sound was the same, because different missionaries worked with those people and wrote down the language, they wrote it down differently. Sesotho, I didn't learn Sesotho anyway, so. But that struck me when I spent some time in Lesotho and discovered that this word means the same thing and has the same sound as the Xhosa word.
Could present a real problem to the white person coming in.
In what way?
Well, because we use, you're an English-speaking person coming in, we're accustomed to that utilization of the written symbol W-E-N-A
mm-hmm.
for the oral symbol W-E-N-A.
Mm-hmm.
but we are not accustomed to the other one,
right.
So we struggle madly.
Right.
Like
so
with
for
those extra letters, and the same thing would be true if it were the French or the Portuguese.
Right. Right. Now, in Xhosa, the adjective is or the adverb is always structured by the noun or the verb that it's qualifying. For example, if you want to say the sun is nice today, it would be ilanga. Langa is sun. Limnandi. Mnandi is nice. In this case, would be adjective, right? Qualifying the sun. Mnandi means nice. Langa means sun. And because ilanga starts IL, therefore, Mnandi gets an L-I sound at the beginning. Now, if you wanted to say the food is nice, you would not, food is ukucha. You would not say ukucha limnandi, because you would say ukucha kumnandi. Makes it present problems for Westerners who want to learn the language, but it's very poetic. You see how the beginning of the adjective in this case, or adverb in other cases, is structured by to be kind of poetically balanced with the word that it comes after, and it makes the language highly poetic and a very beautiful language to listen to. It's always kind of ilanga limnan ukucha kumnan, always structured in that way. And it's a beautiful language. It presents a lot of problems for Westerners who want to learn it because there's no one word for nice. Nice is different according to every... And what it means is that if you try and learn the language, memorize it in a kind of logical manner, you'll never get it. In a classroom, I could have never learned Xhosa. I learned Xhosa by spending 3 weeks in a language training institute, which thoroughly confused me, and I spoke almost nothing after I left that institute. But I did have some understanding of how the language was laid out, and I knew how to work with the dictionary, Xhosa dictionary at that point. So then I started staying in rural areas where if I wanted to eat, I had to work with that dictionary. And because I'd been to the institute, I had some idea of how to work with the dictionary, but it was only speaking the language and listening to people speak it that I picked it up. But it's beautiful, very poetic language. And makes for some very powerful preaching too, I would imagine. I don't speak the language well enough yet to really understand many of the sermons that I heard. But my guess would be that the homiletics or the preaching words are not the same as an academically well-written treatise. To hear the words spoken is more of a dramatic kind of a presentation of the word than to read it, and I think a highly poetic language would make preaching very effective. Another aspect of African language, which is a real cultural strength, I think, are the proverbs. Many of us may be familiar with the notion that African language is filled with all kinds of proverbs, and when Africans are sitting around talking, discussing an issue, often the point, their strongest point when they've been laying out an argument for something, they will conclude that argument by citing some proverb which sums up the whole thing, the whole basis for the truth of what they're trying to say. And their language tradition is rich with these proverbs. I hardly scratch the surface in terms of getting familiar with a few of them because, of course, they're not... what's the word for a language now? There's a phrase in a language which can't be translated literally.
Idioms.
Yeah, the proverbs are highly idiomatic, and so it's difficult for someone who's just got a rough understanding of the language to really pick up the proverbs. But I did have a few proverbs taught to me, and they're very, very profound. One of them that I remember is... translate something like the spot in the cow shows more clearly in the cat. And the aspect of what this proverb means is that I had an African explain it to me once. It can be used to, it refers to one generation passing on a trait to another generation. And it indicates that what may have just been a hardly noticeable spot in the parent generation may show itself much more clearly in the child or in the succeeding generation, which is an aspect of life that is in fact very true. And they have a short, very poetic, catchy little proverb for citing that truth. Another one that I like very much, and that really, most of these proverbs don't translate very well. You lose a lot of the beauty. For example, to talk about spots and cows to a group of Westerners doesn't mean anything what it means to an African whose tradition is pastoral. In African culture today, an individual displays his or her wealth in the herd of cattle that they own. And every animal will have a separate name. And a man who owns 50 cattle will know each one of his cows individually, and will have a name for them, and will be able to go into a herd and pick out the one cattle. And they communicate with their cattle in various ways. So cattle are a highly valued aspect of their tradition. And to tell Westerners of a proverb about cattle doesn't communicate all of that value.
Another, it depends on what part of the West you're in.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point.
David, can I say something?
Yeah.
We want to listen to you and not to me, but I couldn't help but thinking of this, of how this is a present-day example of Old Testament development. That is, Old Testament, and even the early church, became more of the Old Testament communities were oral tradition communities. And what we found out now in biblical studies is that the oral tradition was highly reliable. Secondly, the manner of debate was by the use of a rich fund of proverbs and stories, narratives plus sayings. The setting was pastoral, so that a lot of the references, as we know from reading Psalms or Proverbs, etc., are pastoral, and those images have their potency in that setting. In Tanzania, there's a beautiful little Maasai goat herder's song, which even in translation is so very close to the 23rd Psalm that it's just striking about his fears that he experiences taking care of their land, how God is a great herder, the shepherd, the Lord is the shepherd. But it's just amazing when you look at some African cultures today, how you are immersed in something which was true of biblical communities.
Mm. That's a good point.
Or the women at the well. I mean, the images, even in the New Testament, so many of my village images, it gives it would be a way in which you would experience some of the richness of the Old and New Testament communities by way of African culture.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for adding that, and I hope Larry's spent all of last year in Africa, and if any of others of you have been to Africa, that this is a session about African culture, and all of us as Westerners operate at a great loss, so I hope it's not my session. I hope all of us that know something of African culture will add that as we go along, as Larry has done. Another proverb I taught it here last summer, but I really like it. I want to do it again for several reasons. It shows the structure of the language. It also shows the value given to relationship. Umtu, ngumtu, ngabantu. This is a very common proverb which illustrates a truth that I didn't intellectually come to see until I went to graduate school, studied philosophy and psychology and divinity at a graduate school level. At that point, I learned the truth value of this statement, which Xhosa children would get at the age of about 3 or 4 or 5. It's the same word 3 times. Umtu, yeah. And you see it again here in Mbumtu. You just add the prefix, which gives brings in some grammatical meaning. And Abantu is the plural form of Umtu. So it's the same word 3 times. Person, person, people. A person is a person because of other people. Other people is what makes you human. Not I think, therefore I am. Basing my definition of humanity on an individualistic model. But it's a collective, communal definition of what is humanness. A person is a person because of other people. And if some children were arguing about splitting up some food that their mother could give them, the mother would shout this proverb at them, Umtum gumtum gabantu, reminding them that their humanity is not based on what they can get for themselves, but rather on their relationships within a group. Which is why I guess African children don't have that much problem sharing food.
The African theologian John Mbiki says that in contrast with the Western sense of identity, an African would say, if he or she were to refer to himself or herself at all, would put it like this, because we are, therefore I am.
Mm-hmm. Very different from the Western worldview. And I don't mean to suggest that one is better than the other, although in this kind of a romantic look at African culture, we may lift up the African ways as being worth something. But the point is that there are different ways of seeing the world, and that the best of all would be a collection of all, not one over against another. So a couple of proverbs, which are a real strength of African language and something that I should think, after all the missionaries that have been sent to Africa and all the mission programs going on, that an important aspect of the kind of mission I was talking about the other night when we focused on mission, where I said mission ought to be a process of encounter whereby we learn from the people that we go out to work among, that we ought to have much more emphasis on learning the language of the people among whom we go, not so that we can teach them the gospel, but so that we can understand a basic strength of their cultural tradition, and so that some of the preaching in an African language, for example, can be brought back and shared among us, or some of these proverbs can be communicated to our own culture. Music. Can't talk about African culture without music, and you can't talk about music, so I thought we'd play a little bit. This is a Namibian freedom song. Ayo. Kind of harmony, and in a group you really get a strong sense of this. relating to each other. It takes a certain knack. It's not a rational knack, but it's a sensitivity to each other. If you're singing a song, for me to join in the singing of that song in a way that harmonizes rather than just duplicates what you're singing, I have to have a certain sensitivity to the rest of the group. And so this whole focus of African tradition on the community, communal focus, comes through in the music, just in the way they would harmonize spontaneously with each other. Now, one of the ways in which African music is still very much alive in the cultural tradition today is in their churches, where there are forms of African Christianity that have permitted African music to make its way into the service. And many Europeans taught Africans that, missionaries, for example, in some cases taught Africans that the only musical instrument God really likes in a service is an organ. If you don't have an organ, a piano will do. If you don't have either of those, then you don't have any musical accompaniment at all. And you certainly don't use drums, because drums are part of heathen African tradition. Well, we're beginning to get over that in some places more than others. And in South Africa, there is a whole movement of Christians that broke away from the Western-led churches up to 100 years ago because they felt too constricted in their worship style, and who today have a very dynamic, exciting worship style. I'm going to be talking about these African independent churches on Tuesday morning next week. But for now, I want to play a little bit of the chanting music that comes from their services, because chanting is basic to African tradition and has been brought into the churches and is the basic oil of a service. In other words, the chanting in an independent church service takes place in between everything else. In between any prayer or any sermonizing or any announcements, you always do some chanting. And it might go on for 5 minutes, it might go on for an hour. And it would usually probably happen with some kind of movement, maybe even some dancing. An all-night service will chant for hours and hours on end. Listen to how it starts. One man. Let's do that again. There's a song here which I have from the start, and this is one of the things that always impressed me. One individual, off key, whatever, doesn't matter, starts in with the words, and then you'll hear the shaker start, and then the drum, and then more and more people, and it builds up to a full-scale chant. The old one is ending. Jerusalem, Ikhayalam, my home, O Lady Town Dayo, that I love so much. Come with me, brothers, let's go to that. Always with the drum, and often people will be clapping. Small round hut packed full of people with the drum going in the middle. And you start chanting like that, you do that all night long, and you get pretty hot. It does something to you.
Freedom and creativity. It would be great.
In our services, yeah.
Yeah, but you know where it has come through in American culture is by way of gospel singing, spirituals, mm-hmm. and the blues. There are direct lines, mm-hmm. and that's mm-hmm. the carryover. And if you attend Black American churches that haven't become high church, mm-hmm. There's a phenomenal sense of group participation in which individuals still improvise all mm-hmm. the time. And another combination of an enormous emotional investment in that, combined with fantastic control mm-hmm. of the music as a group. It's still alive in American culture, but it's not white American. Mm-hmm.
I think it's also
in like the Pentecostal churches and stuff like that, the charismatic movement, I think, includes some of that.
Which are less afraid of their emotions than us in our culture sometimes. Yeah, and we're beginning, as in the science of psychology, people are beginning to look at different states of consciousness, and it's becoming a well-known scientific fact that to chant like that, and to clap your hands, and to beat a drum, and to sing for hours on end, is to put your mind, or your brains, to do something to your brain that actually can be energizing. And for that, that's the only way I know of explaining experiences I've had of chanting in a small hot room with a lot of physical energy, exerting a lot of physical energy over a 5 or 6 hour period, and coming out of that, just really, my mind just tuned in, not exhausted at all, but really energized in a way that I can't explain. I mean, in no other situation that I would expend so much energy would I expect to come out of it feeling so energized. And I think that's because of this, you know, what we're beginning to understand about the psychology of trance, physiology of trance, and the role that music and chanting can play in that whole process, which leads us to healing.
Good. I want to make a comment on one of the songs I heard last night. The message of the song last night was it seemed mournful to me. Give me my country back, you know. But yet, to my ears, it sounded happy.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very smiley sound.
Uh-huh.
But it was, you know, he was yearning and mourning over the loss of his country. How do they express? Do they express mourning through more joyful sounds like that? Or
I didn't know if I would want to say that, but that's one of the things I like about that song. There is a combination. There may be a sweet land of our melodies, or land of our sweet melodies. That's a phrase in that language. Now that's a happy, joyful kind of thing, and that's the country he's asking to get back. It is the case. I would feel comfortable generalizing to say that Africans, in their music, put their music together to speak about the conditions in which they live. Well, I guess anybody does that, but in that sense, what we would consider political themes are very prevalent in African music. And it's understood that music is an inspirational mode, and that politics are something we all need inspiration for, whether it's getting inspired about working on a political campaign in this country or fighting for your liberation in Namibia. And music can be an aid in this process. So,
if there are Namibian songs, I was not there. I have only had this told to me by people that were, in which in the church service, and this is part of the reference oral tradition, the person began chanting and started picking up Old Testament themes about how Moses led the people out of Egypt and went through all the great events, and then David slaying Goliath and so on. And then just kept right on going. And so the roll call of the heroes went right up into the present, and started then naming leaders of SWAPO and others, right along with Moses and David.
Now, there are songs on here which kind of lift up the virtues of various leaders in Namibia. And you hear some of them, Bishop Nyamba, you know, some of them are church leaders, some of them are SWAPO leaders, some of them are leaders of other African countries. And they kind of tie them all together that way.
I guess my Western ear is attuned to hearing sad things in a minor key and happy things in a major key.
Uh-huh.
Do you hear minor sounding songs? Do they have that?
I don't know. We need people like Louise to help us on that. We're talking about music here. And I'm so ignorant about music. I had 2 weeks of piano lessons when I was 8 years old. But that's been in my musical. Can anyone else?
Probably not. Listen, by hearing the whole major minor. No, I wouldn't do it.
That song last night, it just, there was such a, I could just see the guy, it seemed like he was smiling while he was singing it. But the message was so
It's true that the harmonies are very repetitious. I mean, you have the same kind of harmony, but I think it's mostly chords. Hmm. And whether you're singing about happy things or sad things, it's very much the same musical construction. Hmm. But I don't know the answer to the question of whether they're majors or minors, which is certainly our way of indicating.
They probably have moods more than different scales rather than like a minor or major key.
Well, what we really need in Christian mission is for somebody like you who knows a little bit about music and has an interest to go to Africa for the purpose of really studying African music and bringing some of that back to us, and figure that while you were there, the African people have enough respect for us that they would also ask you about the gospel, and you would get a chance to do a little bit of what we normally associate with Ike Mission.
I just plug it in here, so I don't know exactly quite how to plug in. But I do know, listening last night, that the chord structures that were used are the traditional 1-4-5, as that's the terminology we use, tonic, subdominant, and dominant. So that interested me. I was wondering if that was an American influence or Western Europe influence on that. That I didn't know.
And also
but this concern for ethnic musics is very much felt in the college communities and in the public schools, that I know. We have a new regulation in the state of Minnesota that all music students for graduating and to teach have to have had some exposure. We have to have certified that they have had a certain portion of their curriculum in ethnic music, and ethnic African music is in there. Now, of course, one of the most obvious gifts that Africa has given to us in its music is its the jazz influence, and that's a very real part. And the rhythmic nature, primarily, of course, is involved there. The harmonic and melodic activity I'm not as familiar with, but their music contribution is very significant. It's really been absorbed through the black heritage that we now have. But I don't know if that was all the question that you were asking.
By the way, this tape of Namibian Freedom Songs includes a wide variety of stuff on it, and if I don't know how to make it available while it's here, I'm not going to give away this copy, but we can make other copies, and if anybody's interested in hearing more of what they heard last night, that's... We'll listen to a little bit more, and then we'll move on. Here's the song from last night that you were asking about again.
I'm also curious about whether that sounds like a guitar to me.
He's using a guitar. Yeah.
Do they have similar instruments that are native to the area there?
I think... Plays, in my experience, a strong role in the healing that happens in African culture. Now this is one of the most difficult things for us as Westerners to think about, because our concept of healing has become so materialized and so so dominated by what are genuine insights and strengths of the Western medical tradition. But I think Western doctors would be the first to say that we haven't solved all medical problems. We haven't solved all health problems through medicine yet. And that where we have certain strengths in dealing with certain kinds of conditions, there are other conditions that we are worse off at dealing with than traditional so-called primitive cultures. And I think the best example of that is in our practice of psychiatry, that I read a book not too long ago looking at healing in different cultural settings and coming to the conclusion that Westerners, in dealing with physical symptoms of ill health, have made unparalleled advances. But in dealing with what we would call psychological problems, we are worse off than most traditional cultures. And never did I become more aware of that than one night. I spent 3 weeks staying at the home of an African healer who is a very dear friend of mine. I call her the old lady. Barbara knows a lot about her. I called her on Christmas Eve. She got a telephone recently. And Christmas is a big gathering point. She's an independent church leader, and the independent churches on Christmas and Easter, representatives of their churches from all over the country will gather at the home of the leader of their church. And she is the leader of a church which has contacts all over the country. So I knew that on Christmas, all these people were gathered at her place. And she had written me about 6 months before and told me that she now had a telephone at her place. So I called her from Oregon on Christmas Eve. What fun, boy. She couldn't believe it. She couldn't figure out who I was. And once she figured out who I was, she said, "Where are you?" And then she said, "Oh, the people are going to be so surprised. Mahazul." So, anyway, I stayed at her place for 3 weeks once, and I had known her for about a year at this point, and she was calling her mother, and she was calling me her son, and we were on very very good terms. She loved each other very much. And I knew that she was a healer, but what I thought that meant was probably, well, she, in her younger days, when she got around more, she used to travel out and do big evangelism meetings, like, and there would be an altar call, and, you know, people would somehow get healed or something. That's what I assumed out of my state of ignorance, that her healing probably involved. And it's interesting in retrospect to consider how many of my own cultural assumptions I had in there. Well, I went to stay at her place once, which, don't get me wrong, that's not an easily accomplished thing in South Africa. I always feel the need to add at this point that don't assume that you can just go and stay in a black person's home in South Africa. It's a very complicated, long story of how I got away with this, and I don't want to go into it right now. But I just want to note that don't assume that you can do this in South Africa. I don't like to give that impression. You can't. It's very difficult. But I was real lucky and got away with it for 3 weeks. Now, I went to her home assuming that healing was something she used to do in her younger days when she traveled around and preached. And as I started staying on this compound, I started to get more aware of all these little buildings on the compound, which wasn't a heck of a lot bigger than maybe three times the size of this building. It's probably about as deep as the length of this building, and maybe three times as wide. That's her whole compound, and there were, I don't know, 20, 30 people living in that space. And previously, I'd just come in the front gate and go straight to her door and sit in her living room and then leave. I'd just go back and forth that way. Well, once I started living there, I started becoming aware of all these other little buildings. And it turns out that people would come up there every morning and every night for treatments. That this was a practicing hospital of sorts. And some of the people who lived on her compound were there for months or whatever long it took for them to receive their kinds of treatments. And that this practice of healing was an ongoing, active phenomenon. And that central to the practice of that healing was music. That the chanting took place at certain regular times during the day, and that people who had come to receive healing, it was expected that they would be more active participants in this chanting than others, that this was a way of making people sensitive to receiving the healing spirit. Now my friend, a healer, was very clear that she did not heal anybody. I'll talk more about this on Tuesday, but she had a strong Christian sense that God had given her special powers to answer the faith of Christians that came to her in search of healing. But that she was just kind of the medium through which God acted to answer the faith of Christians that came to her in need of healing. So don't think that she's some whatever. That she didn't believe in her own powers, but she did believe that God had given her powers to answer. Now, I don't know, we could spend we've spent a lot of time on healing, and I guess the only reason I haven't decided to do a whole session on healing is because I think it's something that we understand so little, and it's something that we, again, as missionaries, need a lot more investigation of, because you don't have to look any further than the most popular publications in this culture, our own culture now, to know that healing, in particular faith healing, is something very much on the minds of Americans. And that it may not be part of the religious life of Lutherans who worship in a Lutheran church every Sunday morning, but it certainly does get into the religious dimensions of people in our culture who may not go to church, but still think of themselves as religious, and who get their religion out of the National Enquirer, reading about psychic healing, that sort of kind of thing. It's something basic to the minds of Americans right now. And for that reason, I think all the more reason for us to go around the world in mission to seek out Christians who are practicing some of this kind of healing that we don't understand as a way of ministering to our own people right here in our own culture. Now, the story I'm going to tell, one night staying on this woman's compound about 11:30 at night after the final evening vespers were over, and I had just been to the old lady's hut to say goodnight to her, and I was on my way back to my the hut that I was staying in, and in the courtyard that I passed through, there were some strangers, some individuals had gathered there, and I thought it was kind of odd that strangers would show up at such a late hour, but I went on to my room, and I closed the door and locked it, as she insisted I always had to do every night. And then I heard these noises, and in the first instant of hearing the noise, I thought it was some animal, because staying in the black township like this, I had gotten used to the fact that there were all kinds of animal sounds that I didn't hear in a white city that I did hear in a black township. But then after listening for a second, I knew that this was no animal sound, but I couldn't figure out what it was until it hit me that this was Amafufunyana, a Xhosa condition that I believe we have no equivalent of in our own culture, although a Western doctor who tried to name it would probably call it hysteria, not to the benefit of the patient who would be subject to his treatments of drugging the patient as a therapy for such a condition. The Bible calls it demon possession. Xhosa people give it the only valid name, I think, by calling it Amafufunyana, because it is a Xhosa cultural condition. And these women, these people that I had passed in the courtyard, in fact, had brought one of their people, a woman, who was suffering this condition of possession. And the sounds that I heard coming from this individual just really scared me in a way that I've never experienced before. And I was, I remembered that the door was locked, and I checked it to make sure, and I was very, very glad that the door was locked. And then one of the children came running in almost kind of a state of panic, saying, "Ugoba ubiza," and the old lady's calling you to come. And then I panicked, because there's no way I wanted to get out there. But the old lady is boss on that compound, and what she says goes, and no one disobeys her. And "Ugoba ubiza" is a command to come. So I went, and she wanted me, she said, "We're going to pray for this woman now." And she wanted me to lay hands on her, and I very gingerly put my hands out there, because the woman was in such an exaggerated state as I had never seen a human being before. I can't begin to describe it. Now, I sat around. The old lady was a little angry that these people had been so impertinent to show up when she was trying to go to bed. So she said, I'll give him just a brief treatment, but I'm going on. Fortunately, one of her assistants was a little more kind-hearted in this particular incident. And one of her assistants said, well, I will light the fires and stay up with her and do the 3 or 4 hour process of giving her the treatments that she clearly needs at this point. Now, let's take a sidetrack here. It's interesting, one of the ways in which Africans, she had living on her compound there, 4 or 5 people who were healers themselves, different degrees. It was her compound and she was the chief healer, but there were other women working under her. And she told me once that the way in which they decide who takes what patients, when a patient shows up, the way in which they decide amongst themselves who will treat this particular patient is determined by whichever one of the healers has been expecting the arrival of this patient. Now, that doesn't mean that the patient writes ahead and says, I'll make an appointment to come and see you at such and such a time. In fact, what happens, and I have no way of explaining this, but I've seen it happen, and I know that it happens. It's true, although I can't explain it. A given healer will come down with the symptoms of a patient before the patient shows up. Now, this happened in African tradition, and it continues to happen among Christian healers in Africa today. I remember sitting once with the old lady, and she started saying, oh, I feel really lousy, really feeling sick. And I said, oh, what's wrong? Didn't you sleep well last night or what's wrong? She said, no, you don't understand. And then she said, kind of matter-of-factly, I think we're going to get some visitors. And I didn't put the two together. Well, about an hour later, a woman showed up that the old lady, the healer, had never seen before. And the woman started telling her her problems, and she was in an exaggerated, she was sick. And Gogo, the old lady, dealt with her, and then we prayed for her, and she went on her way, got some medicine. And later in the afternoon, Gogo said to me, I feel much better now. And me, still being naive, said, oh, did you take a nap? And she said, no. She said, don't you remember, I told you this morning that because I was feeling ill, I thought probably we were going to get a visit from someone who was ill. And that's exactly what had happened. Now, this woman I'm very close to. I trust her, absolutely. She wasn't trying to stage any dramatic show in that incident. That happened. And there's plenty of evidence on the part of anthropologists who have studied African culture to suggest that it does happen in African culture. There is a sensitivity there between healer and patient, which in fact determines who can be a healer. It is not the person who can pay for medical school that becomes a healer in African culture. You have to have a natural, almost kind of, we might call it psychic calling to that profession in African culture. Anyway, one of her assistants agreed to treat this woman who was suffering from Amafukunyan that night. And so starting about 11:30, she lit the fires, and it's a long process. She took her to the healing little hut. And the woman had come with her husband, who now was not your stereotype of a traditional African. The woman's husband was a relatively highly educated guy, spoke English fluently, and I sat around the fire with him for about 2 or 3 hours and listened as he struggled to understand what was happening. Because he told me that, look, I'm an educated African. I've been to university. I sell insurance as a profession. I'm a faithful member of the Methodist Church. And I've grown up always hearing about Amafukunyana, but believing it was a kind of Xhosa superstition. It was part of the backward traditions of my people's superstition. And being a Christian and a well-educated man, I wasn't subject to this kind of a thing. My wife is also a good member of the Methodist Church. Yet, tonight, he found himself and his family, his wife, afflicted with this condition. And he was struggling to understand what was going on. Because he said, clearly, what I've been taught now and what I've believed up to this point is not adequate for helping me deal with this condition on the part of my wife. And thank God there are people such as Gogo here who can help me with my wife. Because if she hadn't taken us at this late hour, the only other alternative we would have had would have been to go to the local Mtata hospital. And in that hospital, they would have given my wife drugs, put her into a deep sleep, and tomorrow when she woke up, she would not have been healed. She would have, eventually the problem would have resurfaced.
What is the treatment like, the four-hour procedure?
There's a problem in communicating this with the with Westerners now, because we always think in materialistic terms. If you're sick, if there's some chemistry which is bad, and you got to give a person a drug, or you got to do something to materially change the condition. So we want to look at physical treatments. And there are physical treatments that I'll tell you about, but I'm not convinced that that's the most important part of the relationship between the healer and the patient. The physical treatments are basically the same in relation to every individual who comes. The only thing that changes from one patient to another is the counseling and the praying and the laying out of hands. There are certain physical treatments which are reserved for particular cases. And to become a healer, you study this for a couple of years under somebody else to learn. But basically, everyone who came for healing treatments at her place got a standard procedure whereby they would start with these old metal wash tubs that our grandmothers used to wash their clothes in. One, take one of these big metal wash tubs and put a couple of 2x4s in the bottom of it so that you would sit on the 2x4s. An individual would get in there, sit on the 2x4s, and then they'd pour boiling water into the wash tub with a little, and the reason of the 2x4s is so that you don't get scalded. The water is at the bottom of the tub and you're sitting on the 2x4s, and into the boiling water is poured a little bit of ammonia. And then they cover the whole thing with blankets so that it's a steam bath.
Yeah.
But if I said steam bath, you wouldn't have gotten the same sense of what happens in that kind of situation. And then while you're underneath the blanket, inhaling this vapor and a little bit of ammonia, the healer would lay hands on you and would pray for you, and would, having prayed for you and laid hands on you, would then say to you, okay, now say the Lord's Prayer, once in English and once in Khoisan. And then say the Apostles' Creed in Khoisan and Sesotho, as healer would tell you what prayers to say for yourself. So it's a combination. After the steam bath, you might be given a solution to drink, which would cause you to vomit. Then you'd be given another solution to inhale, a little cup of water like that, which clears your head out pretty fast. It's kind of a saline solution. I don't know what else at all she would put in it. Pour the water in your ears and in your eyes. Give you an enema. Affect virtually every orifice on your body in a kind of technique of physical cleansing, inside and out, to give you the sense of being physically cleansed. Now that's the physical dimension of the healing, but as I said, a much more important part of the healing process, I think, would be what's happening to you as you go through these physical steps. And there would constantly be conversation between the patient and the healer, and also a lot of prayer and laying on of hands. So that as you're being physically cleansed, you are also having other dimensions of your psyche being dealt with.
How is music used this time?
Before and afterwards, there would be periods of chanting.
You mean the healer chanted?
Well, no, on the compound, whether you're sick or not, first thing in the morning, the first thing you're going to do is go to the chapel, and you're going to maybe read a scripture portion, but certainly you're going to be chanting for a while. And it would be understood that if someone from outside is coming for healing treatments today, they will be part of the chanting first. They'll be in on the service. So it's my hypothesis that the music is part of the healing process. I didn't necessarily get that straight from her. I can't remember her or her. But no, in the services, they would say, too, that people who are feeling a little bit down would attend the services that day and would take care of, would be part of the musical chanting. Some outside academics who study this whole movement, these people would say there are two kinds of healing that happen in the independent churches, direct healing and indirect healing. Now, the treatments I've talked about would be part of the direct healing process, whereby a patient meets with the healer, just one-on-one kind of situation. Indirect healing takes place in their services in the way of all of this music and chanting, and then a blessing. At the end of the service, the leaders of the service would stand in a line, and all the people, as in this one big chant that might go on for 20-30 minutes, and it would just rock the whole building, you know, this clapping and the drum going and the singing at the top of their voice, the whole group. And while that's going on, one by one, they'd walk forward, and each person would have, there would be hands laid on them, and the leader would be praying for them. Well, I can get carried away on it. I think it's one of the strengths of African culture that we know the least about at this point because of our traditional bias. That my friend, the old lady, would often send patients to the hospital. She would say, you come here as well, but you also, if you got a broken leg, you go to the hospital and you get their treatment. Now, there are certain things that she knows she can do that they can't deal with at the hospital, such as amafufunyan. All they would have done at the hospital is pump her full of drugs, which would have quieted her down that night, but would not have cured her problem. But she also knows that there are certain things a hospital can do that she can't do. And she works in conjunction with modern medicine. Now, in the hospital, it's a different story. You can bet that the doctors at the hospital would not be referring any patients that they can't deal with to her because of the cultural bias which says that she, you know, that's backwards, superstitious kind of thing. Now, there are some doctors in Africa who take a more progressive attitude and try and work with the traditional healers, in particular the Christian healers. But they are the exception rather than the rule. And I think that's evidence that we are better as a culture at sharing our cultural insights with others than we are at learning what others might have to teach us. And that's really to our own detriment, I think.
Are we not, on the other hand, beginning to get a glimmer of that holistic kind of concept because there are now medical interns who spend time with both spiritual people coming to bring their gifts to bear on a patient and the psychological as well as just the physical symptom?
Yeah, that's beginning to happen.
Isn't that, yeah.
But again, I mean, that's the percentage of people in the medical profession in this country who are tuned into that is very tiny.
Yeah.
And among those, the percentage of people interested in holistic health who look to other cultures to learn
say,
about
we
holistic
don't look
health
to other cultures.
Is even smaller percentage.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people within our own culture who are starting to look at holistic healing, but on the basis of what we know as a culture.
Mm-hmm. Some are coming to Holland this summer.
Oh.
Both of those groups are. And Karen Michelson has started a holistic health center in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to do religion and health. But she has spent time in India studying it there as an attempt to look at a different culture's offering.
Yeah. And sometimes I really bemoan the fact that, you know, my call was to South Africa and I got all caught up in the political garbage of South Africa because, believe me, there's nothing I'd love more if I didn't feel a kind of political responsibility to deal with the way in which Americans are still involved in oppressing South Africa. There's nothing, I would give anything to go back to Africa and to spend some long-range time at work, you know, on that woman's compound. Just trying to, I spent 3 weeks and it just blew my mind. I went there thinking, well, this would be a good time to write and I'll be with these people. I didn't do a bit of writing because I got on this compound and I found all this stuff going on. It was blowing my mind. And someday I hope in Southern Africa or another part of Africa to get a chance to do that.
Don't you think the prayer group movement too, a tremendous number of prayer groups have sprung up in the last 10 years, some of them charismatic, in which you go on for 2 or 3 hours, very much as you are describing, but not all charismatic, and nearly all prayer groups conclude with the laying on of hands.
Mm-hmm.
And I myself have sensed some of this transfer of illness mm-hmm. to the person who does the laying on of hands and the anointing. And now lay people are given by the priests vials of oil.
Mm-hmm.
And I have one myself. And all this is fairly new, but powerful voices like Agnes Sanford
mm-hmm.
In sealed orders, or Father McNutt, the Dominican who was, although I think he's left the order. It isn't usually in the church building itself. In fact, my own prayer group meets in the basement of a Roman Catholic church. We've not yet been elevated to the real church, you see. But this is very strong in the United States right now, and a healing is certainly part of the the prayer group. Mm-hmm. Some churches, too, now, instead of both priests going to the end to shake the hands of the congregation, one stays at the altar rail. Mm-hmm. So after the service, those who need the laying on of hands can quietly go up there. Now, I didn't know this was happening until 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And now I realize that some of the things you're talking about are right under our noses, mm-hmm. and in the mainline churches. Mm-hmm. That's what's so exciting.
Yeah, and they've been in the black churches.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes. And in the interim at POU, with Dr. Gobi, we're going to have a whole month on holiness and health. Mm-hmm. In the interim, the committee agreed to that. I wasn't too sure that they would do that in an academic setting.
What do you mean by the interim? In January? When you
January, because we're on 4-1-4.
Yeah. Again, I get excited when you talk about these things. Just a couple of stories. It's not on healing, but on other items, on the music. The sense of the whole congregation's participation was always very moving to me in African congregations. I was in a congregation in the bush on Christmas morning. And there came a time of offertory, which in our little house church we call sharing. The time just to tell when people said, you know, I give thanks that my daughter who was ill for 2 weeks is now well, et cetera, et cetera. But here was on Christmas morning, one of the most beautiful of the sharings that I remember was a young mother whose baby was just born a couple of weeks before. And she got up and she just raised this child. I mean, this is after you're hearing the Christmas story, too. Mm-hmm. She just raised the child above her head and she started swaying with the baby, one way or another. And then she started chanting. And then the other people started chanting. Mm-hmm. And then she chanted and they answered her. Mm-hmm. And it was just absolutely, you know, gorgeous to see that expression of thankfulness for the birth of that child. And then the whole congregation just replying to her as she made up this chant, and then they would sing it back, and then pretty soon the harmony would come in. The other thing that was so different from church and where I grew up in Minnesota is that we never danced to the altar for the offertory. In Africa, we were with friends of Buthelezis in South Africa, and we danced up there with the rest of the folks to put the stuff on the altar. I had to laugh because this was an all-day affair. And the morning was a worship service, and in the afternoon would be choirs and other folks and speeches, etc. And we had been dancing for half the day. We were the only white folks there. This is a black township. We were the only white folks there, and one of the folks giving a speech was giving it in, I don't know if it was Zulu or what it was. Anyway, Manas Buthelezi whispered to me because I couldn't understand the language. And so Manas translated and he says, you've got rhythm too. It was really fun. I have to tell you one story about African, so-called African time. And as you know, that doesn't work very well when you move to an urban sector. It's hard to run General Tire or Phillips Radio on African time because we have an assembly line way of doing things. And so the railroads, which are half on African time, but are supposed to be on Kronos, clock time, are in the music, it's in the music transportation system. Well, had a friend in the camera room who got a message that he should try to get somewhere else about as quickly as he could. So he jumped into the missionary's Land Rover, knew what the train schedule was supposed to be, got to the train station, saw the train pulling away, jumped off, started running after the train to jump on. The conductor said to him, "Take your time, lots of time. Don't worry about it. This is yesterday's train."
Now you tell the story, I have to add one now. The story reminds me of with the independent churches, at one point I was visiting one of the lowest ranking. I mean, the independent churches are all considered kind of backward Christians, not educated, that sort of thing. But among themselves, they have various rankings. And I was with the lowest of the lowest one Sunday, which met in a round hut right in front of a bus station in the Black Township. And the leader of this congregation was very adept, dramatist kind of guy. And he knew that people out there at the bus station had seen this white man come into this church. And that just shocked all of them, that any white would associate with that kind of thing. And so he figured that there was a lot of curiosity out there. And he kept the door of the little room open so that people out there could just see this white man being inside. And what he did was, one of the things that everybody knows, this particular group of independent church people called the Zionists, those are the most African of all the Christians in South Africa. Everyone knows that they, ukujikeleza, meaning, jikeleza is a verb to go in circles, and it means you dance in circles. And one of the things that they do in a round hut, you put 100 people around the circumference, clapping their hands and chanting with the drum in the middle, and then some individuals kind of come into the circle and just start going around like this with the tune. And they go faster and faster until you're running in this circle as fast as you can. Now imagine running in a circle as fast as you can. You're going to get dizzy anyway. But you got everybody on the outside of you chanting at the top of their voice, and you got these drums beating real hard in the middle. And it does something to you. So they... he had the door open, and people knew that I was in there. Then he started this jiggle-lazing. And just as he pulled me into the circle, he closed the door. So that anyone on the outside who wanted to see this umlungu, this white man, jiggle-lazing, had to come inside. And people did come inside. Anyway, let me say, we're going to keep going here, but we have been going for a long time, and I won't be at all offended if some of you reach your limit of what you can absorb, or you got other things to do. Just make your way out. This session is going to go over time, I can see. There are a few more aspects of African culture that I want to point to, so as long as there are some who stay, we will, some of us, carry on. But others who feel the need to go, you're welcome to make your own way out. In addition to time and language, we talked a little bit about music. We've talked now about healing. And I want to talk next about forgiveness. This is a category that we cannot discuss African culture without getting into. Bears Now Deer. How many people saw the film the other night, White Lager? Some of you. You remember Bears Now Deer? That man in the film. Extraordinary human being. The film will be shown again next week, probably Tuesday afternoon or something like that. It'll be posted. Bears Now Deer is the individual of all the people that I've met in South Africa. He's the one, I think, who, as a white, has the best sense of appreciation and understanding of African culture and what the promise of it is. And in particular, he's one of those very, very few individuals in South Africa, whites, who got interested in the independent churches, as I've been talking about. Most whites write them off as a heathen, a slide back into heathenism because they use drums in their services and that kind of thing. Well, Bayers over dinner one night told me a story, which I will cite now because it illustrates or it symbolizes what I've heard other people that I really think understand African culture. Every white in Africa will tell you about the African, and will speak about the African mentality and what Africans are like. 99% of them, I throw it right out. I don't, you know, we don't know anything. It's like whites in this country talking about blacks, you know, all about what blacks are like, whether they know them or not. Oh, no, I don't know this golden tradition. We pause for a moment of prayer. Yeah.
This is the solidarity song of white the people of Vietnam, Mozambique, Angola, and Guinea-Bissau. When I remember the people of Vietnam, I just want to say power, power to the people of Vietnam. Angola, I just want to pay tribute to them. I just want to say, Angola, 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 yeah, Angola, Angola.
Bears tells a story about forgiveness, which illustrates, I think, what is a truth to African culture that we have yet to discover. There, it appears, is within African culture a capacity for forgiveness unlike anything we know in our own culture, where we carry grudges with us for ages, even after we've supposedly made up. And it's rare individuals, such as Bears, who have really taken seriously who have really taken a healthy approach to Africans to see what they can learn, who have experienced some of this. But over dinner that night, he talked about, I don't remember all the details of it, but in the course of his working with some independent church leaders or somebody, getting himself in the middle of some, embroiled in some kind of controversy. And he said, pretty soon, these two individuals who had been meeting in his office had gotten involved in some kind of an argument that was just bitter, I mean, extreme. And these people, he would sit there and he thought they were going to kill each other right there in front of his eyes. The degree to which they were arguing and fighting. And this carried on over months and he kept trying to get them reconciled and nothing would work. And he would meet with one side and then the other side. And anytime he got them together, he thought it was just going to be the end of the world. And then he said, this thing had dragged out over months and he was struck by the depth of people's concern over this particular conflict. But then he said the one party came to feel that they were more responsible than the other party. And there was a meeting of the two parties where the one party, which apparently was more at fault, actually, we would say confessed or asked for forgiveness, said, okay, we acknowledge some shortcoming here in what we've done. And he said, from that minute on, these people who had been ready, it appeared, to kill each other, went on as if nothing had ever happened. Now this is the kind of story that I've heard time and time again from those few individuals in Africa who really get to know African culture well. And it appears that, I believe, a real strength of African culture is that where one party admits they're wrong, and it doesn't happen until that point, but where one party will admit an error, the other party demonstrates a capacity for forgetting the matter, unlike anything that we've seen, that Westerners have seen. And Westerners who have seen Africans do this are struck by the degree to which they seem able to do something that if you really wronged me, even if you came to repent about it, I would still carry some feelings in my relationship with you for quite a long time. There would be a certain coolness there between us. But he said, you know, at that point on, they were friends and they worked closely and it was like they were now the closest of brothers and nothing had ever happened before. And I wouldn't cite the story if I thought it was an isolated example. I really think that that capacity of forgiveness is probably an important strength present in African culture and one that we can give thanks to God for, because in a future world where we hope to be more reconciled with the people of Africa, this may play a key role, although of course it doesn't happen without repentance.